funding for THINK comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
Let's assume for a moment your child is brilliant enough to be accepted to one of America's most elite universities, the ones everybody's heard of and dreams of attending. Let's further assume you had the $50,000, $60,000, or $70,000 a year to cover undergrad tuition, room, and board. You'd gladly pay up to have your child taught by the country's best-known intellectuals. Would you feel differently if you realized two-thirds of her professors would be part-timers or those still working toward PhDs? From KERA in Dallas, this is THINK. I'm Chris Boyd. As my guest will tell us, 21st century American universities rely heavily on grad students and adjunct professors to teach undergraduates, while those on the tenure track are essentially discouraged from having anything to do with those studying for bachelor's degrees. And while the problem exists at state universities and mid-tier private schools, it is most pronounced at places like Harvard, Yale, Columbia, and Georgetown, where between 37 and 68% of the faculty are not on the tenure track. Jacques Berliner-Blau is professor and director of the Center for Jewish Civilization at the Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. His new book is called Campus Confidential: How College Works or Doesn't for Professors, Parents, and Students. He joins us from the studios of NPR in Washington, and our conversation is part of KERA's American Graduate Initiative. Jacques, welcome to THINK.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me.
I would have assumed that people who decide they want to be college professors are motivated, at least in part, by an interest in teaching students. But it turns out the process of working toward tenure has the effect of killing that desire.
Yeah, absolutely. I think some of us start off very interested in teaching students, but we're sort of waylaid in graduate school. It's about 10 years that we spend there. And along the way, we learn very quickly that undergraduates are not where it's at.
Your focus here is mostly on the liberal arts. Is that because it's the area you know, or are things really different for folks working in, say, STEM fields?
I really think STEM is different. STEM has a future. STEM has 100,000 provosts who think that this could be monetized in some way. And in the liberal arts, in particular in the humanities, which is what I know about the most, and the interpretive social sciences, I really think we're in a state of crisis right now.
Why are PhDs so miserable, or PhDs on their way to getting PhDs?
The process. I really think that 10 to 12 to 15 to 25 year spell that we do in graduate school really destroys something. It inculcates certain types of characteristics in a person that make them an unhappy person. That's one. But more importantly, that sort of make it impossible for them to do the things that good teachers are supposed to do in the classroom. So if you had a great college professor, and I'd be the first to acknowledge there are many, you really have to ask yourself, huh, how'd that happen? Right? It was a sort of a mistake. It was sort of an accident that somebody was capable after that experience of really committing to students and connecting with them.
So a significant proportion of people who actually teach undergraduates are classified as contingent faculty. What does that term mean?
Right. Contingent faculty means that you're not on the tenure line. And if you want, Chris, I can explain to everyone what the tenure line constitutes.
Please.
So the tenure line, put it this way, it's 2017, and in American higher education, we're using a human resources protocol from the year 1940. This was a statement written by the American Association of University Professors, and it came up with a brilliant idea. And the idea was tenure. What was tenure? You would work at a university for 6 years, and in that probationary period, if you proved your muster, you would be granted tenure, which for all intents and purposes meant guaranteed lifetime employment. And this system worked swimmingly in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. And then all of a sudden in the 80s, we started seeing tenure lines, especially in the liberal arts, starting to disappear slowly, 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 slowly. So those who didn't have tenure are part of what we refer to as contingent faculty. And those are folks who have no guaranteed lifetime employment. They're usually very poorly paid. They work under deplorable working conditions. They can be fired and hired at will. And that's where roughly 70% of American academicians are positioned right now. And to me, that's the problem in American higher education that we need to address.
So a lot of people working in other fields might say, okay, we don't have guaranteed lifetime employment after 6 years of doing a good job. So maybe there's not so much sympathy for that. But the way that contingent professors are compensated, I have to say I don't understand how universities can get away with paying $1,500 or $2,500 a semester to people who come in and teach undergrads.
It's absolutely astonishing. I myself don't understand how it's possible. Now, when I received my doctorate, I spent 7 years as an adjunct or in contingent faculty. I don't know why I did it, but one thing was this. I had invested so much of my life and my psychic energy and my intellect in receiving the doctorate that basically I had no choice. I was also sort of an idiot savant by that point, and that's what graduate school does. It had denuded me of any ability to do anything but what it was I was trained to do, and unfortunately that consisted of reading dead ancient Semitic languages. So there wasn't much of a market for that in the outside world, so I was kind of stuck. I had educated myself into fiscal oblivion.
So I went to college in the late 80s, early 90s, and I had a couple of adjunct professors. But for the most part, they were people who had other jobs in the community and just sort of wanted to give back. That's not necessarily the situation for adjunct folks today.
No. Often we refer to those folks as scholar practitioners. And for them, it's sort of a lifestyle issue, right? They teach because they want to. Most adjuncts today, as I know them, are just teaching to make ends meet. And they're trying to tread water until they can get to one of those tenure line positions or a full-time non-tenure track position, which is a reasonably compensated way of life. That's what they're aiming for. But good luck with that. The market is not friendly to people like us.
Jacques, what happens to professors who manage to earn tenure at a particular university but decide they don't want to spend the next 40 years of their working lives? You know, that's not how most people take jobs these days, right? We move around. Yeah. Do they have to start over if they want to go to another school?
If they want to be hired at another university, you mean?
Yes.
Right. Yeah, that's called lateral appointment. So lateral appointment means you're promoted, you're an associate professor now, which means you've just been granted tenure. And you need to find another university out there that will bring you on board. And that is exceedingly difficult. As every dean in the United States tells a disgruntled faculty member, this is the classic line, you're welcome to look for a job someplace else. And the understanding is there are so few tenure track jobs that the likelihood of being appointed laterally is very, very low, with the possible exception of star faculty.
It's not surprising that a lot of academics pair up as couples. Then you have the tricky situation of maybe one spouse getting on the tenure track or actually receiving tenure and the other trailing along. And it's sometimes devilishly hard for that second spouse to get a decent job.
Yeah, this is at once the most comic and the most tragic aspect of American higher education. These academic couples where one is living in, let's say, New Mexico and the other is in Maine. And they're constantly trying to find ways to spend some time with one another. They try to find a city in between. They try to jerry-rig all sorts of complex contractual arrangements with universities. And generally, it's not an easy life for an academic couple.
This doesn't seem to work very well for professors. Does it work well, this system, for universities?
It might work well for universities, insofar as they're fiscally solvent, insofar as they can pay the bills. I'd say for them, it's, yeah, if they're well run and they're well managed, which means they're brutally run and they're brutally managed, they can make quite a lot of capital off of this. So I think universities that are completely not sensitive to what this does to faculty and undergraduates, and I want to stress that these professorial issues I'm speaking about have traditionally been separated from what happens to undergraduates. And what I want to do in the book is I want to say you can't disarticulate these two columns in American higher ed. The way the professors are treated has a tremendous impact on the quality of American undergraduate education. And Chris, that's an argument that we've failed to make, though I think it's in our interest to really start making this argument now.
One serious concern you have is that almost nobody hired to instruct college students has been taught how to teach.
Right. We never teach folks. I've heard of a few exceptions. I actually believe at Harvard there are some exceptions to this rule, but we rarely teach our doctorates, our training doctorates, our apprentices, in the humanities and the liberal arts how to go about teaching, because the assumption is if you hit the jackpot and make it big, that's going to be a secondary concern in terms of your renowned greatness and awesomeness, right? You're not going to be spending that much time with undergraduates. And it's generally true, by the way, right? If you do hit the jackpot, if your Google Citation Index is in the tens of thousands, if you're a star faculty, you're definitely not going to be spending time with dopey freshmen and sophomore. So the assumption is, why train doctorates for something that if everything goes perfectly well, they'll never have to do anyhow?
But it's so interesting because the education departments of universities everywhere are cranking out scholarship touting the value of pedagogy for K-12 yeah. teachers.
Yeah, that's true. And K-12 teaching, I think, is significantly better than college teaching. And you have many universities that have schools of education, and you have some really, really good people there, right? And they focus on training people to teach those K-12 constituencies. I do think, Chris, there's a movement afoot of really fed up and pissed off folks in higher education that want to start addressing this problem. So it's not as if I'm the only person saying this. There's maybe 5, 10, 15, 20% of American academe that really identifies this as a signal problem in what is happening on the campuses of colleges and universities in this country.
Simple as it sounds, you note that the design of a syllabus can be the difference between a great class and a mediocre one.
Yeah. I mean, we all see these movies, Dead Poets Society. I mean, I know that's a high school teacher. Mona Lisa Smile, right, about these great teachers who have these kind of, they elicit epiphanies in the classroom. And what I've understood as a good college teacher, I'm not a great college teacher, is so much of what makes a class work is grunge work, right? Like coming up with a really good, clear syllabus that sequentially leads students through their paces, that the readings are balanced, the students are engaged, you're not subjecting them to 195 pages of reading a week. And that's kind of boring stuff. And that's stuff you do in July and August before the semester begins, and you really work your way through the calendar. So yeah, syllabus, that's a major thing. I could tell you all sorts of other things, Chris, that I think great teachers do that are really not that exciting.
Well, tell us some of them.
The inner siren that starts blaring when you realize somebody has no idea what the heck you're talking about.
Right.
And all good teachers have that, right? So in other words, they're not so immersed in their own profundity that they neglect to understand that the folks out there aren't following you. And it's pretty typical when you're teaching material as complicated as some of the things that we teach that a lot of 18 to 22-year-olds aren't going to understand what you're speaking about. So I really admire a classroom pedagogue that can stop himself or herself, kind of push back and say, okay, guys, did you understand what I was getting at there? That's a really important teacherly virtue, but it doesn't film well, right? It doesn't look good on camera, right? It's not dramatic. It doesn't have a political hit to it, but all good teachers, I find, on all levels, have that ability.
Does that ability, even with the best teachers, diminish when you're teaching, you know, a survey class with 200 students in kind of an auditorium setting?
Yeah, I am really biased on this. The process you're referring to is known as massification, and this is a very disturbing trend in American higher education. Simply put, the classes are getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. It's a cost-cutting measure. I don't understand how teaching can take place when you've got more than, let's say, 20 or 25 students in a classroom. It just drives me absolutely nuts, Chris.
My guest is Jacques Berliner-Blau. He is professor and director of the Center for Jewish Civilization at the Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. His new book is Campus Confidential: How College Works or Doesn't for Professors, Parents, and Students. Join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program for aspiring creative writers. You can nurture your creative talents and take courses this fall like 21st Century Storytelling. Applications are available at smu.edu/mls.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Georgetown University's Jacques Berliner Blau. His new book is called Campus Confidential: How College Works or Doesn't for Professors, Parents, and Students. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Jacques, would requiring professors or PhD candidates or tenure candidates to learn teaching methods, do you think it would be a further disincentive to tenure-track faculty to take on undergraduate classes, like one more thing they've got to do?
Yeah, probably. I don't think it would be received well by the Guild, though at some point it's going to happen. It'll probably start off at public universities, my guess is. Democrats and Republicans have taken a special interest in the goings-on over at the U, the state university. And my guess is in the next 5 to 10 to 15 years, they're going to get very aggressive about what's happening in those classrooms, especially in the humanities. And one of the things I think they're going to stress is that some type of pedagogical certification be part of a professor's life at some point or other.
It just makes sense from the perspective of anyone who's had a job and then, you know, been kicked up into management, and you suddenly realize that being a good manager is an entirely different set of skills that, you know, may or may not correspond to your to the skill that got you a management job in the first place.
Yeah, right. So the skill involved in being a good researcher, which is knowing how to work in archives, knowing languages, knowing how to measure and balance different sources, is really just completely at an angle or oblique to what it takes to be a good teacher. And this is our fault as professors. We've never really thought this one through for the past couple of decades. And we've never figured out how to integrate good research with good teaching. We're starting to learn now. I mean, we're being pushed by fiscal doom, especially in the humanities. So lately, in the last 5 or 10 years, there's a lot of innovation out there.
You make it clear that you not only enjoy teaching, you like spending time with 18 to 22-year-olds. That's more important than it might sound.
Yeah. Isn't that part of the job description? I know kindergarten teachers who love 5-year-olds.
Right.
I know middle school teachers who tell me, don't believe the hype. It's the best. There's like a dorky majesty to a 7th or an 8th grader. They love the age group. I do think a college professor, if you want to enter this business or racket, you better like working with 18 to 24-year-olds. Now, obviously, not all college students are 18 to 24, but that's the majority of the population. So I'm very confused as to why that literally never once came up in my entire life. I mean, they learn a particular way. Their brains are formed in a certain way. And we never talk about that, right? How they learn best, how they react to knowledge, how they engage with others. And that's really a shortcoming of our field.
In case it's not clear to everybody, Jacques, if somebody is a tenure track or tenured professor and they're not teaching, what are they spending their time doing?
Well, they're off in Rangoon or they're in an archive somewhere. Sometimes they're completely unaccounted for. That's the whole campus novel aspect of my book. I love campus novels. So it's not unusual to have a faculty member that's completely gone AWOL and nobody knows where they are. Strange things happen on college campuses, which is why I like college campuses, but some of it is really dysfunctional and not good for the undergraduates. Where are they? They're generally working on research projects. A point that I go to great pains to make in the book is you would find few people in any guild as hardworking as professors. Mm-hmm. Ask any spouse of any professor in the United States this question, right? What does your husband or wife do on the weekends? We work. We're constantly working. We're constantly behind text. So I don't want people to think that I think professors are lazy. I just think that our passions are directed, our energies are directed towards the wrong horizon. Let's put it that way.
Is there such a thing as a professor respected by his or her colleagues who chooses, after the amount of publication required to get tenure, to focus on teaching?
Very rare, but I've seen them. There are a couple on my campus. These are, I call them freaks, right? Because they do two things well. They're really good researchers, and for some serendipitous and inexplicable reason, they decided they really wanted to focus on their undergraduates. And those people are really, really valuable, right? They're not in high demand, right? Because we really don't place a premium on creating such a type of person. But I think the scholar of the future, if we are to continue to exist, is going to have this sort of profile, right? They're going to be solid researchers who really like being in the classroom. And Chris, I want to add one thing. Mm-hmm. When I talked about things that good teachers do, here's one: being happy in the classroom.
Huh.
Some people are really, really unhappy in the classroom. Most American academicians just don't want to be there, right? So I have tremendous respect for that person that walks into a lecture hall and they're all smiles and all energy, and this is the best part of their day, as well it should be.
All right, let's go to the phones. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also get to us on Twitter at KERAThink. Justin is calling from Dallas. Hi, Justin.
Hi, Chris. I had a question about whether groups of universities, I'm thinking of like athletic conferences as an example, on the institutional side, could offer tenure transferable among them at their leisure. So if there were too many English professors at the University of Indiana and something came up at the University of Minnesota, that people could, a professor could transfer among this group of schools, whether a conference or an accrediting body, to kind of address the problem the guests talked about with spouses and the hard time they have moving among universities. Is there anything like that out there? Is it talked about?
That's a clever idea.
Yeah, it's such a good idea that I know it will never happen in American higher education. It really is a good idea. I bet you there's probably an initiative or two out there. But for the most part, these things are extremely difficult to pull off. Generally, the problem is that, well, there are lots of problems, but I think departments don't like having colleagues foisted on them. A university department, especially in the humanities, is a very delicate ecosystem, right? And you put a new person in there and, you know, we're so sensitive that we have a very hard time accommodating the new guy, as it were. It's a very, very good idea. I can't really see it coming to fruition, though.
What is the difference between the top 100 or so, what you call destination universities, and the thousands of lesser-known colleges that people may not have heard of, but that might be giving out perfectly, you know, respectable educations?
So here's the shocker. I think the ones beneath 100, the universities ranked 125, 150, I think the teaching is better. I think the commitment to the undergraduate is much greater. I think the resources of the institution towards pedagogy are delegated in a more responsible way. And I have experiences teaching on all levels. I've taught at community colleges. I've taught at third-tier schools, second-tier schools, and elite schools like Georgetown. And I really feel that there was something about those schools that weren't in the top 100 where the faculty was more likely to be pushed into the service of educating the great American undergraduate.
What about the hiring of faculty at these universities? Is there something just magical about somebody who gets a tenure track position at Princeton versus, you know, State U somewhere?
Yeah, I wrote a piece in the Chronicle of Higher Education where I argued it's completely serendipitous, right? There are so few jobs that when a tenure line position opens up, basically an entire civilization of scholars applies for it. So you have this search committee, about 300, 400. How can we possibly parse these resumes accurately? The parallel I draw, Chris, is to NFL football drafts, right, where you have tens of millions of dollars that are devoted to assessing athletic talent. And regularly in football, they're busts. All right, you pick somebody who looks great and then they get there and they fail to perform. That's going to happen a lot more frequently in American higher education, where we don't invest in the selection process. So what I've noticed, I mean, I remember this when I taught at Hofstra University. I was in the Comp Lit program. As I look back at it, we had four or five people there that were, I don't want to say world class, but they were absolutely top of their fields, right? And this was Hofstra. It's a small liberal arts college on Long Island, right? Because Hofstra was making a lot of really good decisions in the 90s with its faculty. So that clearly had benefits for the students insofar as Hofstra felt entitled to force its faculty to deal with its undergraduate population. So there's a lot of value underneath number 100. In the United States, ranked 100, the school ranked 100.
How can enrolled undergrads assess the effectiveness of the instructors that they're given to choose from? If they can choose, you know, section, this section or that section, how should they go about deciding who to pick?
Yeah, so I'm speaking directly to the great American undergraduate. Please don't take the professor who you know is not going to assign a lot of work and who never showed. Please don't do that, kids, really. I always tell undergraduates, go for the professor about whom you heard a lot of complaints, but the complaints conduced to being a very educated person. Mm. I love that type of professor. Oh, she worked me so hard. She was unrelenting on my essays. When she used to hand me back an essay, it looked like she had slashed her wrist on it. There was so much red. I mean, I like that type of professor, right? That's a professor that is buying in to your education. So my advice to undergraduates is actually listen to undergraduates. And if you really want to get the most out of your education, go for the professors that have a reputation for being really, really difficult and hard and accessible, right? Hmm. Not just these kind of aloof virtuosi. I'm talking about a professor who's known to be a real, can I use this bad word, hard ass in the classroom. I have such respect for those scholars.
My husband told me a story the other day of his first year as an undergrad, and he wasn't understanding something in a class, and he went and sought out the professor, and the professor said, follow me, and he went and picked up his mail or something and then sat down for 90 minutes and explained this so that by the end of it, my husband walked out understanding.
Yep. I have colleagues who do that, and those are the people who I feel we are the future of American higher education, so big shout out to all you guys wherever you are in those godforsaken college towns, but those are the people that are going to save American higher education from itself, right? Either those people get together and we start brainstorming, right, and trying to affect change, or everything is going to collapse around us. And by everything, I mean the tenure system, which is right now on life support.
My guest is Jacques Berliner-Blau. He is professor and director of the Center for Jewish Civilization at the Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. His new book is Campus Confidential, How College Works or Doesn't for Professors, Parents, and Students. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, I want to go back to the phones now. This time we have Donna calling from Frisco. Hi, Donna.
Hi. Very interesting conversation. I hate to contradict the professor, but when I went to college, my father was warning me that I was probably only going to get the teaching assistants. But in fact, at several schools I attended and took courses at, Barnard College, Columbia University, University of Rochester, I got almost exclusively full professors, some of whom were absolutely brilliant teachers. They just had the gift. And one of my favorite teachers, Professor Joseph Viscomi, was a teaching assistant, but he taught an English, freshman English class, one of my favorite classes. He's now a full professor somewhere else, but, you know, he was fantastic, as were all these full tenured professors.
Well, do you mind if I ask, Donna, what decade you went to college?
Well, that's a good question. I'm kind of a weirdo because I was a professional ballet dancer, and I went to college both in the 70s and didn't graduate till 1992.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your call, Donna. It sounds like maybe things have changed since then, Jacques.
Well, for one, I'm really happy that we've produced a satisfied customer. That's great. So that does happen. I don't want to say that there's never good teaching on American college campuses. What's interesting is she speaks about being taught almost exclusively by full professors. For those who don't understand what the term means, after you get tenure, you're an associate professor, and then you go through kind of another process and you become a full professor, and that's the end of the line. And that's as much, let's say, validation and renown as a professor can have. Generally, full professors are loath to engage with underclassmen, with freshmen and sophomores. So she had, I do think she had an unusual experience. But I don't want to foreclose the possibility that some people in the United States of America have had great experiences in college. On the contrary, right? I do believe this happens. It happened to me. I just want it to happen more frequently. And I want it to happen in a way that expresses concern or sensitivity for those 70% of American professors that are living under very, very difficult conditions right now.
Do you have colleagues at Georgetown who are appalled that you are spilling the secret that Georgetown uses a lot of contingent faculty to teach its classes?
Yeah, I mean, I've always appalled people my entire career. So that's why tenure worked great for a person like me. I mean, I'm sort of I'm a throwback, right? Mm-hmm. Your professor used to be like your crazy uncle or your crazy aunt. So I was always that type. So I'm not worried about appalling people. What's a little bit different about Georgetown is because it's in Washington, D.C., and we have this tremendous pool of talent from government, think tanks, armed forces, A lot of those people come to Georgetown really not wanting to be tenure-track professors, and that's why our number is pretty high. Not that things are ideal at Georgetown, as all-American college campuses, but I believe we're up around 69%, last I checked, of contingent faculty. I'd say a good 40% of those 69% are people who are ambassadors or policy wonks, right, or who have some very, very special form of expertise that are happy to teach one class at Georgetown.
All right, back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Carter in Sachse. Hi, Carter.
Hi, Chris. This is my first time calling. I've been listening for a while now.
Welcome.
I'll be attending university in the fall, and for a while I've been primarily interested in becoming involved in research. I was just wondering what steps I can do to stand out and maybe secure a position early on.
Well, it depends what type of research, Carter. What field are you interested in?
I'm in the STEM field.
Oh, I don't know. The future is yours, put it that way. Don't listen to a fuddy-duddy like me. I come from the humanities. I think there's going to be a lot of growth in STEM. My biggest question is, will there be tenure-line jobs in STEM? So congratulations, young man. You've made a wise decision, and I think the STEM fields offer far more possibilities. I was terrified that you were going to say you were interested in Victorian literature, and that would have been a frightening scenario.
What about people who really have a passion for, you know, studying something that is pretty arcane? Mm. I mean, what sacrifices should they be prepared to make?
Yeah, I mean, that's essentially what I did. I mean, I was studying things that nobody had any interest in whatsoever. So I think those of us who want to do that have to be prepared to suffer what Henry James called the consequences of our infatuation. Hmm. So there are a lot of people that are 22, 23, and they become obsessed with these poets or these really obscure issues. Good for them. But I think we all have to understand what the risks are and how few or how scant the rewards are.
My guest is Jacques Berliner Blau of Georgetown University. His new book is called Campus Confidential: How College Works or Doesn't for Professors, Parents, and Students. You can join us by emailing think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can cultivate your appreciation of great works of art by customizing your study with courses this fall like Inspiring Creativity Through Original Art. Applications are available at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Jacques Berliner Blau. He is professor and director of the Center for Jewish Civilization at the Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. His book is called Campus Confidential: How College Works or Doesn't for Professors, Parents, and Students. Join us at 800-933-5372. Jacques, earlier you mentioned, you know, your department might receive 400 resumes for one particular job you have open, and it's really hard to assess the individual merits of each candidate. So it's the same as you're surely aware for parents and students looking at schools. There's only so much you can learn from websites and all that literature they send you in the mail and even campus tours. And so we turn to the rankings, right? We look at U.S. News and World Report. How valuable or not are those ratings in telling us what our student will get at University A versus University B?
I would say nugatory, valueless. The one thing I will say is those top 20 schools, what I find astonishing about them is the group of students that they amass, all right? That is special. Right? I mean, if you're looking at those top 20 schools, those kids, I mean, I've sat on admissions committees at Georgetown, and I've looked at these CVs. I've looked at these applications from prospective high school seniors. And I've wanted to break down and cry, right, feeling so inadequate, right, recognizing the level of talent that is out there. So one thing I will never deny, that at a top 20 school, an elite American college or university, the pool of folks that you're in with, and that's a big part of the college experience, is probably a really important factor to consider. I mean, I have a doctorate in sociology, so I could never deny how important it is to be around really, really, really bright people. What I'm categorically claiming in the book is that doesn't hold for the professors at that university, because the great professors who are there are rarely going to spend any time with the undergraduates. And that sort of work is going to be parceled off to lesser known scholars. So if I were to choose a top 20 university, I would do that knowing precisely why. And the single greatest reason is the effervescence created by all those brilliant young minds concentrated in one place.
It seems a shame that the way it works, the best universities reward students with the prestige of having gone there because they managed to get in, if you know what I mean. Right. It's no small achievement, but it really is about what they did from birth through age 18 rather than reflecting any sort of growth that might happen during college itself.
Hmm. Yeah, that's absolutely true. We talked about 18 to 24. 18 to 24 is such an incredible age because so much growth can happen in those years, right? I mean, so much can change in a human being's life in this country at this particular moment in those 4 to 5 years that they spend in college. And you're absolutely right. I mean, once you're in, and you're in there, unless you do something really silly, until you graduate. So it doesn't really reflect who you are or what you're capable of doing.
So here's a really cynical and sad question. Let's say the teaching is objectively better at school 148 than at school 28. What do you say to students who have graduated from school 148? How do they sell the value of their education to potential employers if they don't have that brand name degree? Even if they learned more, will anyone believe it as they're applying for jobs?
I think people will. I mean, we spoke about the NFL. I know we're out in Dallas, so I mean, you guys like football.
A little bit, yeah. Right?
If you look at a football roster, I mean, what are there, 52, 54 men on the roster? Like 20 to 25 of them are from schools you never heard of before, right? And that is the single and believe me, football is an industry that takes its recruitment very, very seriously because there's so much money to be made and so much glory. So what I would say as a word of encouragement to those at school number 148 is we have seen again and again and again how people from school number 148 often outperform and outclass somebody from Princeton, Harvard, or University of Chicago. So I certainly wouldn't despair, though it's true that when the resume comes in, they have much more to prove than somebody that comes from one of the elite schools.
All right, let's go back to the phones. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Nyemike is on the line in Dallas. Hi, Nyemike.
Hello, Chris. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
This is a fascinating topic. I talk about this with my undergraduate friends all the time. I'm set to finish my undergraduate degree at the end of this year. And as I've gone through, I've come across a couple of different frustrations, if you will. I hope I'm not taking the guess too far backwards, but one thing that I have definitely noticed is that faculty members are definitely more immersed in getting published and doing their research, and thus the undergraduate education like definitely falls on the back burner, it seems. But what I wanted to get the guest comment on was, and this may not be something that is entirely unique to higher education. I'm sure this exists in all different types of professions, like across the board. But once one reaches a certain age, you know, like say 50, 60, 70 years old, and they're in a profession, and let's say they're shooting for retirement, or you only have a couple more years to go in education specifically, whether or not a professor is tenured or not, what type of incentive does a faculty member have to improve? Like, say, for example, they're in 60 or 65 years old, and they feel like this is the finish line for me. This is the professional finish line. There's nothing further. What type of incentives do I have to maintain or I have to reach for in order to improve my teaching?
Yeah, one of the problems of the tenure system, and you find a lot of critics of American higher education making this criticism, is once you have tenure, what is your incentive, right? What is your motivation to excel at anything? You're in. You have lifetime employment. Now, interestingly enough, public universities are beginning to experiment with a new technology, Chris, and it's called detenurification. This was unheard of 10, 20. I mean, you'd only be detenured if you committed some sort of an index crime. But now we're seeing more and more state university systems that are creating commissions often not of faculty, because that's what the AAUP 1940 statement insisted, that if somebody was going to lose tenure, it was the faculty that was going to make the decision. What we're seeing now are state systems that are putting together administrators, non-faculty members to run decisions, to pass decisions on what we call deadwood. Deadwood is an expression for a kind of tenured professor that doesn't do anything. So in response to the gentleman's question, what incentive do they have to say? They have very little incentive, right? From the moment you receive tenure, the kind of the carrots and the sticks are all gone. And this is precisely why the tenure system has become so oddly obsolete. And we need to do something to clean it up.
You would think that there would be a more elegant term created by a bunch of liberal arts scholars than detenurification.
Yeah, I hope we don't hear too much of that term, but if you read the Chronicle of Higher Education, it really does seem to be a new trend, especially at state universities.
What is the collegiate learning assessment?
Collegiate learning assessment, in that book, Academically Adrift, which made a lot of waves, the take-home message of Academically Adrift is we're not doing a very good job educating our students. So it's a metric. It's a metric to measure what undergraduates learn. I believe you're going to need the sociologists and the demographers who did this to tell you more precisely. I believe between first and second semester of freshman year and like last semester of junior or first semester of senior year. So it's an interesting metric because it doesn't look at what you learn in a class. It kind of looks longitudinally at what a student learns across 2, 3, 4 years of college. And the results were not promising, and this created a sort of outcry about what the heck are we teaching these kids or how are we teaching them in American universities. And with that part of Academically Adrift, I completely agreed that there really is a problem with the way we're educating our students.
College-educated parents, certainly, and a lot of parents who didn't have that opportunity for themselves, really want their children to have, at the bare minimum, a bachelor's degree. Do any of the shortcomings you reveal here cause you to question, at least for some students, the value of an investment in a four-year degree that is likely to cost tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars?
Yeah. I'm not that jaded yet. I know what college did for me. I know what it did for so many of my friends. I believe it made me, in many ways, kind of a real citizen and a human being, as treacly as that sounds. So I'm not ready to go there yet, but there are very powerful and often convincing arguments to the effect that people would be better off learning a vocation. It wouldn't cost hundreds of thousands of dollars, and we'd have much needed electricians and plumbers and carpenters. And so you'll see an emerging talking point in discussions about American higher education is vocational training over the liberal arts, and in particular over the humanities. And I'm always stunned at how ham-fisted the response is from professors in the liberal arts and the humanities as we try to defend what it is that we do. We need new arguments, right? We need a new compelling reason to say the reason why it's okay to spend $150,000 to $250,000 on a college education is this. Here's the deliverable, and nobody else can give it to you. We are very poor at making that argument.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Let's go back to the phones now. This time we will speak with Bill in Fort Worth. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I just want to say that I had a philosophy degree. I have a philosophy degree, and I've been in finance for a long time, ran a hedge fund. I'm an entrepreneur, and it's the best thing I ever did. I've been grateful every day for my humanities degree. I have four children with lots of degrees, and they all ended up in skills like medical school and so forth, and good for them. But for me, philosophy taught me how to think. It taught me how to see both sides of an argument. It contributed to my great fascination with everything in life. And so kudos to humanities, and I'm sorry to see it in decline. I understand why that's the case, but for me, it's been a huge contributor to my life.
Thank you for your call. I heard you laughing, Jacques.
I thought he was going to go a different direction with that. I thought he was one of the many folks that had a doctorate in something and left and was absolutely delighted, right? But I'm really happy Bill should be kind of the poster child for the humanities. But his story is not, Chris, one that you don't often hear. You hear this a lot, right? You hear a lot of people looking back from a distance of two decades and saying, oh my God, the things I learned in college, all the things it did for me. I was a linguistics major, and now I run a hedge fund, let's say, or I own a company, but I understand the value of that experience towards what I later became. So Bill makes the argument, unfortunately, better than many American professors make the argument.
Are you starting to see talented academics bailing because they just can't make it work financially or in terms of quality of life?
Yeah, I started seeing this a long time ago. I started seeing talented young people, like 23 to 28, spend a year in graduate school, get a taste, and then say, that's it, I'm out. And that has worried me quite a lot because I don't think it's the case anymore that the best and the brightest become professors. I do think that was the case 4 or 5 decades ago, but my impression just looking at the current crop of graduate students is they're not often the smartest person in the room. They might think they're the smartest person in the room, as all academics do, but I do think there's a bit of a talent drain in American higher education. Word is out, it's not a good gig. There are not many opportunities. And the absolute most brilliant folks are going other places, be it Silicon Valley or venture capitalism or organic avocado farming, whatever it might be, right? They're not venturing into American higher education. That's really sad.
Well, we tell young people that the reason they are in college is to get a good job later.
Yeah, and that's fair. I have no problem with that very pragmatic logic. That's the logic that many state legislatures want us as professors to embrace. And in my own teaching and work at Georgetown, we embrace that logic as well, that our job is to position these kids, amongst other things, to get the job they want. I think that's the most important thing. Right? What is it you want to do with your life? All right, our job is to help you get there. And I feel we as a guild have to start embracing that as part of our mission. We have to listen to our kids, figure out what it is they want to do, and help them get there as best we can. And I think that would be a really kind of noble and helpful goal for us.
Could you have written this book if you didn't have tenure yourself?
Probably not. It's going to be heard differently. There are other versions of this book written by infuriated and aggravated adjunct professors that are very good, by the way. But I think this is a little different because this is not the type of book that a tenured professor writes. So I'm trying to lend whatever gravitas that position might endow me with, right, to this argument that we have to think very, very carefully about our undergraduates and about our long-suffering colleagues who are not on the tenure line.
Jacques Berliner Blau is professor and director of the Center for Jewish Civilization at the Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. His new book is Campus Confidential: How College Works or Doesn't for Professors, Parents, and Students. Jacques, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thank you for making time for us.
Thank you so much, Chris. This was fun.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is our technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. And Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle is at KERA Think. Subscribe to the podcast at think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.